The hour of 10:15 having arrived, we will call the House Tax Committee to order. We have a bit of a change in the agenda today for an informational hearing. Property taxes was canceled this morning at 8:15, I believe, for obvious reasons. And so at 2:30 this morning, I was with Representative Murphy. You know, that just doesn't sound right, does it? Just the facts. And we had folks coming down to testify from the city of Proctor, and it was kind of hard to contact them to say that the meeting had been canceled. So in deference to the representative from Hermantown, we are going to have an informational meeting. We're pulling this over from property taxes to have an informational hearing on this bill that was supposed to be here at 8:15. Members, I also contacted Representative Hilty. He had a bill up in property taxes regarding the county of Carleton. We'll deal with that later. Representative Hilty did not have anyone coming down for that bill, so we will work on that later. So we will get into the reason I'm doing this today is because I can. Okay, so with that, Representative Murphy, would you please come to the table on House File 1749? You have, we'll go about till about 10:30 because we do have a full agenda, but I did want to have the Tax Committee hear about House File 1749 as the situation we're in on the floor till about 2:30 this morning, as you know, and they couldn't be contacted to cancel or reschedule. So with that, Representative Murphy, welcome to the Tax Committee. It's good to have you here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you for your accommodation. I just am not technologically able to call people at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I didn't have the phone numbers, and I knew they'd be on their way as I was coming across back to work, so I couldn't contact them. But House File 1749 is a bill that was requested by the city of Proctor, and with me today is Councilor Jake Benson of the city and the president of the Proctor Chamber of Commerce, Rich Borg. And they would like to tell you about the need that they are asking for a food and beverage tax.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. If you could please state your name, sir, and who you represent for the record.
Jake Benson, City of Proctor.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thank you for the accommodations. Proctor, so you know where it's at, is bisected by Highway 2 and I-35. We're bordered on two sides by the city of Duluth that happens to have a food and beverage tax as well. Theirs is a little more than twice as much as what we're asking for. You know, Proctor was created to serve the mining industry, but yet we've been excluded from the taconite tax relief area. 20% of all land in Proctor is owned by Canadian National, which has some yards in town. Proctor's only 3 square miles, 3,000 people. But 28% of all the developed property in our community is owned by that railroad. Recently, the railroad forgot to break one of their rail cars, and it went through our train crossing, and the only crossing in town, and we ended up losing our silence zone. No whistles blow on those trains, 20, 30 seconds at a time, virtually hour per hour, because we have that much train traffic. To replace that quiet zone, it's going to cost $250,000, and it's going to be the taxpayers, not the railroad, that has to create that quiet zone. And the railroad pays a fraction of what any sort of commercial or residential property pays in Proctor. Proctor's 2012 general fund is lower than its 2009 budget, and our general government budget was 31.5% lower than it was last year. Proctor, for the past 40 years, has been at the entrance to Proctor or to Duluth Spirit Mountains Recreation Area. Duluth owns 80 acres of some of the most expensive, if not the most expensive, property in the state of Proctor, or in the city of Proctor, and They pay no taxes on it, yet we still have to provide services to those 80 acres. And Proctor for the past 91 years has been the entrance to the South St. Louis County Fair. So our roads take a pretty good beating as well as our services. Over 90,000 visitors spend a night in Proctor at one of our three hotels. They go to our equine facility, our half-mile racetrack, our regional recreation center, our gun club, our golf course, and of course, Spirit Mountain. Proctor also plays host to the Blizzard ALS fundraiser, and it's the largest snowmobile fundraiser of its type in the United States, raising $750,000 a year. Proctor is also home to the MS-150, where they start their race, which happens to be the longest and largest bicycle fundraiser in Minnesota. And like many cities, Proctor's had a challenge these last couple of years. We had to get rid of our entire parks program, summer parks program. We most recently lost a park worker, an office staffer, our canine officer, our animal control officer, a school resource officer, our city administrator who has a master's of business degree, and a lifelong Proctor resident, MBA I should say. He's working as our city administrator for $14,000 a year. So that's just some of the reasons why I think, and I ask for your support in passing 1749. The last time we had a local option sales tax in Proctor, it passed by an 11-to-1 margin. Our voters get it, and this is a tax that would help solve some of those challenges that we face. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Councillor Benson. What we'll do now is I'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order, as we do have a quorum. If the next person could state his name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Rich Borg. I'm the Proctor Chamber President.
Please spell your last name.
B-O-R-G.
So you're on the City Council?
Proctor Chamber President.
Oh, Chamber President. Okay. Mr. Borg.
Mr. Benson has obviously given you a lot of detail about Proctor from the business community. We see that the city resources are limited. The city buildings, public or the Proctor Area Community Center, these facilities are in need of repair and have been for a number of years. We see additional tax dollars going into repairs there, into staffing. We've, like Mr. Benson stated, with patrol officers being cut back, city staffers being cut back. We also have the Kirkus Street addition that goes through the center of Proctor is being constructed at this time. We're hoping to develop business lands and bring in business. We have 90,000 visitors to our three motels in a year, and we have wear and tear on the road surfaces. And we've recently acquired the South St. Louis County Fairgrounds from the county, and we'd like to see some development happen there also. So from a chamber perspective, it's bring in business, keep city functional, and pump up tourism.
Thank you, Mr. Borg. Any questions for Councillor Benson or Mr. Borg? And again, members, this is an informational hearing that was going to be heard in property taxes, but because of the early morning floor session, we had folks coming down, for those of you that just came here, and so we're just having an informational meeting. Representative Carlson, then Anderson. Representative Carlson.
This is more a curiosity question. You mentioned that in Proctor, 80 acres are owned by the city of Duluth. And I represent a district where two cities have large areas of their cities that are owned by the city of Minneapolis. One is Theodore Worth Parkway. Being from up there, you may or may not know where that is, but it's the largest World War One memorial in the state, and that's located in the city of Robbinsdale but maintained by the city of Minneapolis. And then some of you may have heard of Theodore Worth Park, and probably 80 or 90% of that is located in the city of Golden Valley, maintained by the city of Minneapolis. It's Minneapolis Park. So I'm just kind of curious why there's 80 acres owned by the city of Duluth, and what services you provide and what's on those 80 acres, and maybe why there wasn't an agreement some point in the city's history where that would be maintained somehow if there's activity there by the city of Duluth.
Councillor Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that began 40 years ago. It was owned by some Proctorites. The city of Duluth wanted to acquire it for the Spirit Mountain Recreation Area, and they got the St. Louis County to do an adverse condemnation on there, on that parcel. Those 80 acres right now pretty much serve as an overflow parking lot, but it is the entrance to Spirit Mountain. The services that are provided are mostly police and fire for that section.
Yeah. And Mr. Chairman, I was just curious, being that I have a similar situation with, I represent parts of Golden Valley as well as Robbinsdale, and that's a long-time arrangement going back probably to about 1900 or thereabouts, but thank you.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Representative Anderson, and then we're going to get into the bills for the day. We'll have Representative Murphy wrap it up, and we'll go forward. Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if this is a question for Representative Murphy or for staff. Is there an automatic voter referendum on this to approve the sales tax?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, no. These taxes would be imposed by ordinance.
Okay, and just a quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Murphy, I heard one of your testifiers say that the last one passed 11-1. Is there a reason why you didn't have a voter referendum included in this bill?
Representative Murphy?
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, there is no reason except that this is the way that the City Council presented it to me.
Representative Anderson? Okay, thank you. Representative Murphy, if you want to wrap it up.
Mr. Chair, I really appreciate, as I said before, your accommodation and for your consideration of our request, a 1% tax on food and beverages. The city around Duluth, which borders Proctor on two sides, has a larger percent of on food and beverages, and it serves them well, and we would like to follow the example of expanding our services to the businesses that do come and to the recreation opportunities that the council and the chamber working together want to offer the citizens of the region. And we think that this bill would aid significantly in doing that.
Thank you, very much, Representative Murphy. Okay, we will now move on. Thank you. The folks from, does Proctor have its own high school, or are you in with somebody? Or?
Yes, sir.
The Proctor Rails.
Celebrating 100 years this year.
Rails?
Rails.
R-A-I-L-S?
For yes. Railroad. For the railroad. It's a railroad town, over 100 years old. We have a plane and we have a train that is on the golf course and the recreation area, opening the gateway to the recreation area.
Well, Representative Murphy, now you've piqued my interest. A golf course, I might need to check this out on behalf of the committee, of course.
Nine hole, wonderful.
No, it's 18. You just go around twice.
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair? Okay.
Councilor Benson.
If I just might want to footnote one thing. Proctor was the largest inland iron ore sorting facility in the world, and we also have on display the largest and most powerful locomotive ever built.
Well, thank you very much. I'll be up to check it out.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Councilor Benson. Okay, with that, Representative Runbeck moves the minutes of March 20th, 2012. Any additions or corrections? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Runbeck. I will now move, so it is before us, House File 2691. And this is, again, one of the governor's, the department's technical bills will go through, a policy bill. We are very fortunate today to have with us from the department, Susan Von Mosch. Members, I will move House File 2691. I will now move the 0787 amendment to get the bill in the shape I like, and we'll discuss it from there. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Okay, 2691 as amended, we have before us. Okay, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. My name is Susan Von Mosch. I'm with the Department of Revenue. 2691 is the department's policy bill. The ideas and provisions in this bill were developed by department staff starting in the summer, and then they came up through the department through pretty extensive review. The first article is focusing on the estate tax. Ms. Jenny Ryan will talk about that. Article 2 is the property tax provision. Lance Sturica will be discussing that. Article 3 is the sales tax with Mikhail Garber, and Article 4 is the special tax, is also presented by Mikhail Garber, and Article 5 is miscellaneous with Joan Tucci. Some of the things that we want to say about the estate tax, which has really gotten a lot of attention lately, is that the focus of the department's provisions related to the estate tax were really to make clarifications to the language that was passed last year, which created a new small business and qualified small business and farm exclusion. And so we were, the department, as that bill was passed and enacted, started receiving a lot of telephone calls about how it would be administered. And so our focus was on developing language that would answer the questions about administration as we understood the intent to be within the original language as passed for ease of administration. There is a clarification, though, that has the potential to affect future revenues if it is not corrected, and it deals with the passive loss rules. And we will have Ms. Ryan come in and talk about that, and Dr. Paul Wilson is also here if you have further questions about the implications of that.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Von Mosch. We will go through each item, and with each article after the presentation has been made, we will ask for commentary or testimony with the concerns or supporting various provisions. I have a Brian Lakin and Jennifer Lammers on my list right now. Is there anyone else that would want to testify for or with concerns on Article 1, just to kind of get an idea here? And also, members, please look at the revenue note. We don't really need to go through it other than I suppose we could have the and the summary is part of the revenue note here. I don't think we need to call Ms. Schill or Ms. Templin up to tell us that it's zero. Okay, so with that, Ms. Ryan, welcome to the Tax Committee. If you could please go through Article 1.
My name is Jenny Ryan. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue. As already mentioned, Article 1 relates to the estate tax exclusion for qualified small business and qualified farm property that passed during the 2011 special session. And after it became law, the department received a significant volume of calls and emails with questions about how the new exclusion operates. We took some time to study the language that passed, including the House Research Bill summary, the revenue analysis of the bill, and we met with a number of outside partners, including legislative staff, members of the Bar Association, representatives of the Farm Bureau, the Minnesota Farmers Union, and the National Federation of Small Businesses. Our work was to identify those items that could be improved as a technical matter to clarify legislative intent and make the exclusion more administrable, both for the department and for taxpayers. All of the effective dates for the provisions in Article 1 are the same as the originating bill, which was effective for estates of decedents dying after June 30, 2011. To start, Section 1 responds to a concern raised regarding revocable trust planning. And under the law that passed, to qualify for the exclusions, the property was required to transfer from the decedent to a qualified heir. And so if a decedent made use of revocable trust to distribute assets at death, the transfer from the decedent to the trust would not qualify for either exclusion, and we suspect that this was not an intended result. Section 1, along with the author's amendment, corrects this by providing that a trust, whose present beneficiaries are all family members, is a qualified heir, thus allowing for revocable trust planning. Sections 1, 2, and 4 make clarifying changes to the requirements for small business property. First, the language that passed during the special session adopted the Internal Revenue Code test for material participation. And the way in which that test was adopted suggests that the legislature intended to require that during the tax year, the taxable year that ended prior to the decedent's death, the trader business activity was not a passive activity within the meaning of Internal Revenue Code Section 469, and that the decedent or the decedent's spouse materially participated in that activity, again, within the meaning of Internal Revenue Code Section 469. The proposal here makes that clear. Second, the language from last session excluded cash and cash equivalents from the value of the qualified small business property. This proposal extends that exclusion to publicly traded securities and to assets not used in the operation of the trader business. Third, this proposal excludes agricultural land from qualifying as small business property. Agricultural land, of course, nevertheless, may qualify for the exclusion as qualified farm property. Fourth, the language from last section required that the decedent continuously own the property for the three-year period prior to death. And this test is administrable for owners of an interest in a business entity, but it doesn't necessarily work for sole proprietors who may die owning inventory or other operating property that they replaced during that three-year period or upgraded during that three-year period. So this proposal allows, in the case of a sole proprietor, that if the property was replaced by similar property within that three-year period, the replacement property will be treated as having met the three-year ownership test. Of note, while the proposal seeks to clarify that agricultural land must meet the test for qualified farm property to be excluded, farmers could have farm operating property and as part of their adjusted taxable estate, and this would need to meet the requirements to be excluded as small business property. So for a sole proprietor farmer, the language here is pretty important to somebody who dies owning grain or tractors or other operating property that's not part of the land. This clarification on that three-year period of death should help sole proprietor farmers. Fifth, the proposal provides that for the three-year period following death, that the same passive loss and material participation tests apply to the family members that are operating the business. Sections 3 and 4 make clarifying changes to the requirements for qualified farm property. First, the language that passed during the special session referenced a farm that meets the requirements of Minnesota Statute Section 524. But instead of setting out qualifications that must be met to own farmland in Minnesota, Section 524 operates to exclude some non-family-owned entities from owning farmland in Minnesota. So the proposal here, including the author's amendment, is working to clean up the language to be consistent with the operation of Section 524 by clarifying that the land must be agricultural land as defined in that section and must be owned outright or through an interest in an entity that is not excluded from owning agricultural land by Section 524. The proposal also responds to concerns we heard from farmers who farm the land themselves and farmers who rent the land to others to farm. So of note, unlike the small business exclusion, the exclusion for the farm property does not require material participation, meaning you can meet the requirements for the exclusion whether you farm the land yourself or you rent the land to be farmed by others. Nevertheless, the language that passed last session required that the qualified heirs operate the trader business that they inherited. And that could be read to mean that if you're a decedent who rented your land, your family members who now own the property have to rent it also. They couldn't farm the property and meet the exclusion, and vice versa. And we suspect that kind of disconnect was not intended by the legislature. So to fix this, the proposal removes the requirement that for the 3 years after death, the family members continuously use the property in the operation of the trader business, and replaces it with a requirement for that three-year post-death period that the land be classified for property tax purposes as Class II agricultural property. Third, the author's amendment clarifies that the property tax classification that needs to be met prior to the death of the decedent will be tested for property taxes payable in the year of death. Section 4 relates to the recapture tax, and here we have a similar problem for sole proprietors. So the test requires that for the family members inheriting the property, that they maintain ownership for a three-year period after death. Again, that works if you've inherited an interest in an entity like a partnership, but it makes it impossible to sell your inventory or to upgrade your operating property if you're a sole proprietor. So this creates a reasonable test for sole proprietors, allowing the qualified heirs to replace the small business property with similar property and not be subject to the recapture tax. That concludes the testimony on Article 1.
Thank you, Ms. Ryan. Anyone in the audience who wishes to testify in support of Article 1 or with concerns on Article 1? Okay, Ms. Ryan, thank you very much. Very good job there. I'm sorry, Ms. Ryan, if you don't come back, questions for members? I'm sorry, Ms. Ryan, I guess we're good. Okay. To Article 1. Okay, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brian Lake, representing the Minnesota State Bar Association. I have with me Jennifer Lammers, who's an attorney at Briggs & Morgan, who specializes in estate tax law.
Welcome to the committee.
The new farm and estate tax exclusions that passed during special session have generated a lot of concern and confusion amongst lawyers. I think out of the several dozen issues the bar's working on this session, I think I've gotten more phone calls about this and seeking greater clarity here than on probably any other issue they're working on. We did raise these concerns with the department early in session, and I do want to say we really appreciate the department's willingness and their hard work to try to tackle these issues and try to clarify the statute for practitioners and for these small business owners and farmers that are trying to benefit from these changes. The department included some changes in their bill that we think definitely improve that area, but not quite all the way to where it needs to be. I know there's an amendment today, and that also makes further progress, but we still believe there are some more clarification that needs to be added to the statute. And I will let Ms. Lammers just touch on a few of those issues.
Ms. Lammers, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Jennifer Lammers, and I represent the Minnesota State Bar Association.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some of the issues that we are concerned about are that just that the statute in Section 9 and in Section 10 further address that transferring from a trust at the death, a revocable trust, is not in violation of the statute. Also, on Section 10, on the qualifying farm property, the way that the statute's drafted is homestead property is what is what is exempted. You'll see on here that it says the homestead, and what is concerning to a lot of lawyers and farmers is that they operate farms that are non-homestead. So there is ag non-homestead property, and we would like to entertain the idea of expanding that definition to also include Class 2A property, to just have the property that's excluded not be limited to the homestead, but be limited to Class 2A property, which is ag property.
Okay, Ms. Lammers, so let me get this right. I own a farm.
Yes.
I have it homesteaded.
Yes.
And then in another township, I own 160 acres over there. In another township, I own 150 acres over there. So what you're saying is that my 160 acres I have homesteaded would qualify, but the others wouldn't?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Whoa.
Yes.
That was, okay. We have a little work to do on this. Thank you for pointing that out. Other questions for members for Mr. Lake or Ms. Lammers? Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a question for Ms. Lammers. I'm just trying to track this issue back.
Mm-hmm.
Are the concerns you're raising, specifically to ag land here, for instance, a result of last year's tax bill or previously existing statute to last year's final tax bill?
Ms. Lammers?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dabney, My understanding is that it is having to do with last year, the tax bill that was passed last year, the bill as it exists.
Representative Dabney?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. It seems when we make public policy in the dark night, behind closed doors, where the public doesn't get to weigh in, we then spend time cleaning up the mess that we made.
Representative Dabney, it wasn't that dark.
That's bright, very bright.
Very bright. Well, since some of us weren't allowed in the room, I wouldn't know.
Point well taken.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Any other questions from members? Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Lake and Ms. Lammers. We will be talking more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I do want to reiterate that we appreciate the department's efforts here, and we hope to continue to work with them to clarify the statute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, ma'am. Okay, Article 2, Property Taxes, Mr. Lance Starica. And members, just, you know, any time that we have a tax bill in the first year, it's quite common in the second year that there are technical bills that go forward. That is not uncommon. Mr. Starica, if you could please describe Article 2. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, my name is Lance Starica with the Department of Revenue.
Welcome, committee, sir.
Thank you. To explain Article 2, before I do that, I just want to get on the record quickly that without getting into details, there will be situations where the property of the decedent that is located separately from the main parcel will be a part of the homestead, and the staff can get into those details later on. Going on with Article 2 now of the bill before us. The first section will provide clear authority for the Commissioner of Revenue to collect the air flight property tax. Section 2 has to do with what's called the sliding scale market value exclusion for electric generating plants. There's a percentage exclusion of market value for each percentage that the equipment is efficient over 40%. Right now, if we find out in a year that a plant meets this criteria, it's not implemented until the next assessment year. I think last year we had somebody that we got the notification in January or February, but weren't able to implement it until this assessment year. This change will provide that as long as we know by July 1st, we can readily accommodate that. So it just moves up the implementation of the exclusion. Sections 3 and 5 have to do with agricultural homesteads. They make, depending on how you count them, 4 or 5 changes. I think I'll just spend 30 seconds how we get here and why we have all these details about agricultural homesteads. And, of course, somebody else would tell the story differently, but back in the 60s, we used to tax rural land different than urban land. So, and I don't know why people got dissatisfied with that one. But apparently they were. So we switched from all rural land tax one way, urban land another. To you had to be a farmer. If you were in the rural area, you had to have a farm. And again, I don't know if other people appreciate that. That leads to a lot of definitional issues about what we still. Maybe we know today, but I can remember just a few years ago, how do you tell a farmer from a non-farmer? With your indulgence, I used to say, you go into town, you look for the person whose fingers look like branches from an apple tree. There's more to it than that. So, with that background, in Section 3, we're updating, modernizing the definition of person for property tax purposes so we can use it later on. Then in Section 5, we're making a number of changes. The first one, I think I have these in the right order that they appear in the bill. First one will make intensive livestock and poultry confinement operations agricultural, even if they're less than 10 acres. Excuse me. Back up a second. When we switch from rural and urban to agricultural farms and not, one of the things that we've had all these years since about the time of doing that is this threshold of 10 acres. If you've got 10 acres in production, it's kind of a safe harbor. You're home free. It's the ones below 10 acres that give us a lot of problems, definitionally. What's the difference between a residence that has a little bit of hay and a farm that has a large farmyard? So the first change we're making here is we want to treat intensive livestock and poultry confinement operations as agricultural, even if the footprint of that confinement area is less than 10 acres. Number two is a hyper-technical, I think, provision having to do with RIM and conservation reserve programs and stuff. Back in 2002, we had to decide how we're going to treat those lands once they go into the program. And we decided that a fair way to do it would be if they were agricultural classification, as they went into the program, they could keep that classification. But going into the program wouldn't make them agricultural. The way it was written, land that was agricultural in 2002 will qualify to stay ag if it goes into one of these programs. Well, you know, it could have been a gas station from 2003 to 2011. So we're just clearing that up, that it has to be agricultural when it goes into one of these programs, and then it can stay agricultural. The third change has to do with parcels that are between 10 and 11 acres, or 10.1 and 10.99, something like that. A scenario was proposed to us where the property was 10.1 acres in size, meaning it was over 10 acres, but because there was a house garage 1 acre, which we administratively treat as residential, there was no way for that parcel to have 10 acres in production. And make a long story short, it didn't fit in the over 10 acres category, and it didn't fit in the under 10 acres, and the 10 acres or less category, because we administratively take out this acre. So this just clarifies that in those kind of situations, when we say less than 10 acres, we really mean less than 11. If there's a house and a garage and an acre that we're going to take out, just to clarify that. Finally, strengthening the language a little bit. This is the way it is now, but we're strengthening the language a little bit so that if there is a house on one of these parcels that's less than 11 acres in size, the use is not exclusively agricultural because there's a house there, and they must have one of the three listed intensive ag uses to get the property agricultural. And all that's effective the day following final enactment, because it's virtually the way we do it now. Section 4 has to do with rural preserve property tax program. Relatively new program, was enacted in 2009, I think, but just effective for Pay 12. And we're just tweaking it to make it more like the Green Acres program. The first change provides that if qualifying property is sold to a new owner who maintains the qualification, we don't have to start over. We don't have to have the old owner pay back the 3 years and have the new owner qualify. There can be a seamless transition from one owner to the next, as long as the property is continuing to qualify. The second change provides that certain things are not even considered a change of ownership. Transfer to a surviving owner if one passes away, transfer by reason of marriage or divorce, and putting property into one of these farming entities. Section 6 is just eliminates, I'd say accounting, but it's not really accounting. Right now, non-homestead, single-unit residences are in two different classes if they're located on an agricultural property or a non-agricultural property. We're just making that all the same. There's no need to make that differentiation. And counties report it all as non-ag now anyway, so we're not losing any detail. Section 7 has to do with administrative appeals for railroad and utility properties, and long story short, we looked at the process and got 30 more days for the railroads to allow them to submit their administrative appeal, and 45 more days for the utilities by looking at when things were done. And that will be effective for next assessment year. That's Article 2.
Thank you, Mr. Sturica. Anyone from the audience who wishes to testify on behalf of or with concerns on Article 2? Mr. Sturica, you might want to, there's a few member questions we might want to stick around here a little bit. I have Mark Hort, Erickson, and Kiffmeyer. Representative Mark Hort.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I'm Mr. Sturica, I'm referring to Section 5 on that part where you're talking about the 11 acres. And so my question would be, so right now if you have someone with the house garage first acre and they have from 10.1 acres to 10.9 acres, would they now move from homestead to non-homestead? Or that would be, or would not be considered agricultural use? What would happen in that situation?
Mr. Sturica?
Mr. Chair, Representative. I'm going to try to be a little humorous but totally honest at the same time. Someone proposed that very same question to us. 10.1 acres and the person grows marigolds for sale. As far as we know, that is not a real situation. As far as we know, there's no one who's been denied an agricultural classification because of this above 10 and below 11. We have been asked the question. As far as we know, it is not a real there's no real situation like that out there, so that if we make this change, we'll be ahead of the game.
Okay. Mr. Chair? Well, thank you very much, because that was my next question. How many of you knew around the state that might impact, and you're saying that there probably is no one right now that...
We have tried to... Chair, Representative. We've tried to find out. We've talked to the person who asked us the question, and as far as we've been able to determine, this will not preclude... There's no one who's been denied this, but if it ever comes up, we will now have an answer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Mr. Sturica. There's a number of provisions here, and most of them in the property tax area and some in the estate that deal with agricultural land. Have you met with the farm groups on this, farmers, the Union, Farm Bureau, and so forth? Because a lot of these are agricultural issues.
Mr. Sturica?
Mr. Chair, Representative. To repeat what Ms. Ryan said, I believe the department has met with all those groups with regard to the estate tax changes. With regard to the changes in this article, the department has discussed this with as many assessors as we could find, trying to build confidence that these changes represent what is going on out there. So we have not met with those groups, but we would be glad to. But we feel very confident that the changes in Section 5 represent the status quo.
Representative Marquardt?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would personally feel more comfortable if they would have some input on these provisions, if possible.
Ms. Von Mosch, to the Marquardt point.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt, as part of our department process for assembling these bills, in December, we did send out what we call a matrix, which is it's not the language of the bill, but it is a summary of what our proposals are likely to contain. That goes out to a group of stakeholders, and there are probably about, well, I can't remember if it's 100 or 200 names on that list with all of the interest groups that we are aware of that have concerns about all of our different tax types. We sent the lists out. We did get comments back. That was part of the process of us winnowing out some of the proposals that were in our list of ideas in up until that December-January cutoff date. To my knowledge, we did not hear anything back from any of the agricultural groups on these proposals at that time. But if you would feel more comfortable, we'll have some more conversations with them. And as Ms. Ryan did state, we did have meetings with the independent small business and the farm groups on the estate tax items.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Marquardt. Okay, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Sturica, I live in rural Minnesota, and reviewing some of the property tax statements for my farmers in this truth in taxation situation this last late fall. I don't know if what you're doing in sections, well, maybe not three, but in five, is going to make their tax statements more understandable, because it seems to me now that we're adding an additional classification. And when I look at their property tax statements and see how they have to contend with all the different classifications of different acreage, of different types of land, plus the homestead, plus everything else, I can't make sense of it. And so, you know, my concern has been that we try to narrow the classifications for all properties instead of expand them. Now, maybe this is a good move, because maybe this is more clarification. But could you comment on to the extent that, well, maybe farmers do understand this, and I'm just so ignorant, I don't, but how do we reconcile all those different classifications of their properties and then make sense out of it so that the farmers ask me, well, why does this parcel cost me this much in taxes, and this one's across the road, and it costs me this much more or less, and they're the same kinds of land, and I grow the same crops on them. So, yeah, I was frustrated, and I didn't know how to answer them.
Mr. Sturica?
Mr. Chair, Representative, just to clarify, you're speaking of Section 6?
No, I Mr. Severson. Chair and Mr. Sturica, I was looking more at Section 5, okay, where it states that, and it's somewhat Representative Marquardt's sentence about the 11-acre parcels and some of that. But mine is a larger question, just all of the classifications of property for ag.
Mr. Sturica?
Mr. Chair, Representative. Take a long time to say that that's a tough nut to crack. I believe there's a bill this session that would have the department and others look at the property tax statement to try and improve the situation. As you alluded to, to add to what you said, there's a ton of stuff going on a property tax statement, or when we tax a piece of property. There's more steps involved than I probably have fingers. One of those parcels could be in a watershed. One of those could be in a special service district. One of those parcels could be in Green Acres or not in Green Acres. The minor little thing I was going to draw in on Section 6 is that we are getting rid of one of the different classifications.
Yes,
it's just a minor, but that really is minor to the issue that you're talking about. I think I'll stop there. It needs work.
Thank you.
It needs work. It's not being done here.
Yes, well, then that's what I shared with them. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just shared with them that we need to do some different.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Members, I'd like to announce someone who has joined us here. That's a gentleman that's a former member, Representative Dan Larson. We're glad you're here. Representative Jim. Representative Jim Girard, we're glad you're here. But no, we're very fortunate today to have with us Mr. Paul Coles, former member of the Tax Committee. Welcome. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Coles, I was trying to find you over there, and then I discovered you have something special on your face. So now that I see through that, good to see that. Mr. Chairman, in regards to my questions, sending a matrix out is not the same thing as sending language, because language gives context. And so did you follow up with this matrix by sending out any language?
Ms. Van Wash?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the language was not available until it was I take that back. We did share the language with legislative staff in January. However, the language, I believe, was not publicly available until the bills were introduced, which I can't remember the exact date, sometime in February. We do encourage people who receive our matrix, though, to call us and and meet with us, and we did have meetings with several different groups of people as a result of releasing the matrix and sharing that with them.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I don't find that real comforting at all. I think that it is really important for you to initiate that. And I know how these things go through in commissions and departments and agencies. These things go through a lot of internal review and language things. And it is very common amongst all of us to send out preliminary drafts or early drafts so that we can give people a chance to see the context of those changes. And the other thing is that sending it out to assessors or people who might be on the list, I think the Farmers Union or the Farm Bureau and the customers really need to have a voice in this, because these are things that affect them, not just the assessor. These things affect them. They are the ones that need to comply with these things, and that they need to be able to have a voice in these things and have understanding and contribute to that. To just to leave it, I mean, this is the thing that annoys the heck out of people, and saying, well, we leave it up to you to just kind of go a regular citizen out there, figure out what's going on. But I think when you have a known group like the Farm Bureau and the Farmers Union and those who can quickly help you in regards to getting this out to their own individual groups, I think you're missing a very valuable part of the process that I would expect, if you're bringing legislation, that's the kind of thing you try and do, and especially when you have an agency and all of those things. Mr. Chairman, in regards to Section 4, question I have in particular at this time then is line 5.26. What is the effect of adding new language, sold, transferred, in addition to no longer qualifies under Sub 2? Could you explain to me, what's the effect of this kind of change of language?
Mrs. Jerica?
Mr. Chair, Representative. This language on line 5.26 and 5.27 is related to adding the paragraph on the next page, and you don't have to look at that. What the paragraph on the next page says is that certain transactions are not going to be called sales or transfers for the purpose of disqualifying. Well, if you're going to say that certain sales aren't going to disqualify you, then you're going to have to say that the other sales do. It doesn't make any sense to say some sales won't disqualify you, but at the same time, you know, you have to say that the logical implication of that is that there are some that do. And so it was necessary to clarify that if you have a new owner, the property is not going to qualify. The new owner is going to have to come in and qualify on their own. And then, one behind every door, behind every choice you make, there's two more choices here. So we had to clarify. There are some sales that will disqualify you. We're adding a list of those who don't. And if the new owner does qualify, there's not going to be the need for this kind of artificial, the first one pays back and the second one has to start over again if both of them qualify. So it's all kind of a package wrapped together. And this language about if it's sold and transferred, you no longer qualify, is part of that package trying to clarify. I'm sorry, I'm not laughing at the situation. It's just hard to explain. The part about clarifying that you are going to just be disqualified is part of the package of describing when you aren't disqualified. I apologize if you can't follow that.
Okay, members, we do need to move along. We're only on Article 2, and we have a runback bill to do here today that needs to get out today. Not get out today, but be heard today. So, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just conclude and make it really brief. I think the simplicity here, Mr. Starica, is that on the next page, as you called it to my attention, line 6.8, For the purposes of this section, the following do not constitute a sale or transfer. And that is the two lines that I believe, but it says subdivision 2. So I think I have some context there, Mr. Chairman. This is just one of those situations that I'm really leery about this in particular because of the of not having those farm groups and some of those things. It's just one of those things that is very complicated. And Representative Erickson, I think your point is well taken, and that when you have to go through back and forth and look at all of this, I pity the poor people who are trying to comply with this. And so I know in the future, but in the meantime, I'm a bit leery of just making those changes for those reasons. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had similar comments, Mr. Chair, similar concerns to Representatives Marquardt, Erickson, and Kiffmeyer. Mr. Chair, wondering if before we act on this bill that Ms. Von Mosch and Mr. Starica could sit down in a room with Mr. Peterson and Mr. Raddatz and work through this for a couple hours and come back to us at some point in the near future. I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Von Mosch, to the
Mr. Chair, members, point. Yes, we would be more than happy to do this, and we do consider this hearing as an opportunity to get all of this out on the table, and we'd be more than happy to do that.
Thank you, Ms. Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. Good suggestion. Okay, with that, we'll move to Article 3. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Okay, Mr. Chair. My name is Michal Garber. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee. First of all, before Ms. Garber starts, is there anyone in the audience on Article 3 that would like to testify on behalf of or with concerns about Article 3? Okay, please provide your testimony on Article 3.
Okay, Article 3 includes one provision which deals with sales tax and exemption certificates. This provision complies with requirements under the Streamlined Sales Tax Agreement. The law currently provides that when a seller obtains an exemption certificate after being requested to do so by the Department of Revenue, the seller is required to obtain the information in good faith. This proposal clarifies the meaning of good faith. The exemption was available when the sale was made. It applied to the item purchased and was reasonable to the buyer's type of business. The proposal also explains that relief will not be available to a seller if, at the time of the exemption certificate is obtained, the seller knew that it was materially false or the seller knowingly participated in an activity intended to evade the tax due. Article 4.
Okay, let's stop here with Article 3. Ms. Dalton, how does this affect the SSTUA? Does it get us any closer to the promised land or not? If you could join us. Please state your name, who you represent for the record, please.
Pat Dalton with House Research.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this provision is one of two provisions that SSUTA asked us to address in our last compliance review. This one has no cost, and my understanding is it pretty much mirrors what the department was doing. It just, our language did not mirror what SSUTA requires for language. However, there is another issue that has not been addressed.
Okay, and we will talk about that later. Thanks, Ms. Dalton, for that clarification on the SSUTA. Questions from members on Article 3? Okay, with that, we will then go to Article 4. But before we start on Article 4, is there anyone that wishes to testify on behalf of or with concerns about Article 4? I do believe we have Mr. Egger. Okay, so we'll be calling you down. Anyone else that wishes to testify on behalf of Article 4? Okay, please proceed.
Article 4 deals with changes to a number of tax types. I will start with insurance. Article 4, Sections 1, 7, 10, and 11 deal with the auto theft prevention surcharge. These sections authorize the Department of Revenue to collect the surcharge previously imposed under Chapter 168A for the Automobile Theft Prevention Program. This proposal codifies a previous agreement between the Department of Revenue and Commerce under which Revenue collected the surcharge. The insurance companies subject to the surcharge are already paying other taxes that are imposed under Chapter 297I on insurance companies. Section 1 describes the program. The program provides financial support to different agencies in an effort to reduce the incidence of car theft. Section 7 states that the surcharge is imposed on each car insurer at the rate of 50 cents per vehicle for every 6 months of coverage and is deposited into the automobile theft prevention account. $1.3 million must be transferred to the general fund. Under Section 10, insurers are required to file a return four times a year. Section 11 repeals Section 168A40, Subdivision 3 and 4. These subdivisions are replaced by Section 7, Subdivision 1, and Subdivision 2 of this section. Sections 5, 6, 8, and 9 deal with the tax on purchasing groups. Purchasing groups are entities whose businesses are similar with respect to the liability to which members are exposed and who purchase liability insurance on a group basis. The change relates to purchasing groups that do not purchase insurance from a licensed company. Section 5 adds purchasing groups to the list of entities that purchase insurance directly from a non-admitted insurer. Section 6 removes purchasing groups from Section 297I05, Subdivision 12. Sections 8 and 9 change the due date of the return from filing twice a year to filing once a year, similar to other taxpayers that purchase insurance from non-admitted entities. The rate remains the same at 2%. Section 2 deals with the deed tax and modifies the meaning of consideration for purposes of conveyance of real property. Under Section 28720, Subdivision 2G, in cases other than when a gift is made, the rebuttable presumption is modified so that consideration will be at least equal to the market value of the property. This will be based on the latest assessor's estimated market value and the county's property tax records. Under current law, the presumption applies only when consideration is not expressed as a specific amount. Section 3 deals with the tobacco product taxes. It modifies the definition of wholesale sale price. The change replaces current references to price list with reference to the price at which a distributor purchases a tobacco product. The previous definition referred to a price for which a manufacturer or person sells a tobacco product to a distributor. The new language ensures that all distributors have the same tax base, which includes federal excise taxes. The change follows some recent Minnesota CARET cases. And the last section, Section 4, deals with tax credit for brewers producing fermented malt beverages. The proposal replaces the referral to calendar year with a reference to fiscal year to be consistent with other references in this section. It also explains what is meant by a brewer who is owned or controlled. This completes Article 4.
Okay, we have someone, I believe they'd like to testify, and then we'll go to questions from members. We'll start with Representative Gottwalt after Mr. Egger is finished.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'll wait till testifiers are done.
Okay, thank you, Chair Gottwalt. Okay, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Paul Egger. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Realtors. I do want to share a couple of concerns with the mortgage or with the deed tax provision, which is in Section 2 of Article 4, which is begins on page 21, line 24, and the language changes are on page 22, beginning with line 16. And I just want to thank Ms. Von Mosch, Mr. Sturicki for discussing these provisions with me over the last couple of days. But I do want to express some concerns with the language. In my discussions with the department, I believe they're trying to address some specific situations, and the concern that we have is that this change is actually very broad. And you just have to look at the language, particularly what's being stricken in lines 16 and 17. So the change, as you heard from the department, is changing the consideration for calculating the deed tax. So the situation you have right now is if you have, I'll just use an example of an arm's length transaction, a buyer and a seller. The transaction occurs and the deed tax is calculated on the consideration, the selling price of the property. It appears that what this change would do is it would tie the deed tax consideration to the property tax assessment records, the latest assessment in property taxes for property tax purposes. And as all of you know from looking at your own property tax statements over the last several years, values have fluctuated. So in the market we're in right now, you could have a situation where you agree to a price, the transaction occurs, you go to record the deed, and if there's a challenge to that agreement, the fair market or the fair market value that the parties agreed to, this language would seem to indicate that if there's a dispute, if it's challenged by the recorder, that you'd go back to the property tax records. And that figure could be significantly different than the purchase price given the fluctuations in the housing market. And in my conversation with Mr. Sturica, he pointed out something. You know, I pointed out the example that in this market, you're likely to see a price agreed to in an arm's length transaction where the price is significantly lower, unfortunately, than what's on your last property tax statement. But in the boom years of the housing market in the early 2000s, you could have the opposite. So this could work both ways depending on the status of the housing market. And I think this is a pretty broad change, and we just have some concerns about what the impact would be moving forward on those types of transactions.
Well, who's carrying this bill?
With that, Mr. Chairman, those are our concerns on that provision.
Okay, points well taken. I think we'll want to look at that a lot closer, Mr. Egger, as we proceed. Thank you for your testimony. Okay, with that, Representative Gottwalt, and then we'll go to Article 5, unless there's other questions. Representative Gottwalt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I may have some other questions later, but initially, I'm looking at page 22. Section 3, and I'm wondering if this addresses the issue we had with the cigarette rolling machines about taxing the wholesale price of the tobacco rather than trying to get at categorizing these small producers as manufacturers.
Ms. Garber?
I'm sorry, you're dealing with Section 3?
Section
I'm on
3,
page 22, 22, yeah.
22, 3.
It's Article
22.31.
Article 4.
This is supposed to be dealing, Mr. Chair, Representative, with the tobacco product taxes and is a response to some court cases where somebody other than a wholesaler sold the product. And the McLean case said that the whole price of tobacco was not a manufacturer's list price, but the price that the taxpayer actually paid to the sales company affiliated with the manufacturer case.
Representative Gottwald, I didn't put my, that's not my bill. Well, it is now, but not the one you're referring to. Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, I'm not trying to badger the testifier either. I'm not sure that answered my question. Were you here for the discussion about the cigarette machines? We've kind of had a bipartisan discussion about whether or not by taxing tobacco more at the wholesale level, we would avoid kind of unintended consequences of trying to regulate small producers and manufacturers and all that. Can you help me with that?
Ms. Van Mosch?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's my understanding that this provision does not deal with the roll your own definitions that we were talking about, that would be a separate item.
Rishon Gawal?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I had one other question here. It appears we are putting a new tax on under automobile theft prevention surcharge. It's not a big one, but we are adding to the cost of automobile insurance by a buck a year, it looks like.
Where's some Gottwald? What page are you on?
Sir? I'm sorry, I'm on page 24.
Support.
Line 24.32 and going forward to page 25.
Mr. Mike, I believe that is already being charged. We're just moving it around a bit, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's correct. I think it's in Chapter 65B or something. I don't know the department.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this tax has been around for a long time. It's just moving now from being enforced by the Department of Public Safety to the Department of Revenue.
Great. Thank you. That's all I have.
Representative Rukavina.
Chair. Representative Gawal, I remember the argument about this. We had a big discussion on this a couple years in a row on this hidden tax, and if you want to move to get it out of here, I'll support you.
I believe that this was a...
It's for giving the cops more money. They got enough money. way I look
McGuire
at it.
The McGuire bill? And I think I was the only Republican that voted for it. Of course, I got paid a commission on the...
That was your
real life. Oh, okay. Yeah. That's right. Okay. Representative Rukavina.
No, I was just wondering. I mean, really, I mean, it is a hidden tax, and it's not much, but it is just out there giving money to do this and that. You think Representative Drazkowski would be the one to move this, move to remove it.
I can see some amendments being drafted shortly. Okay, with that, we'll move on. Thank you very much, Representative Gottwald and Rukavina. We'll now go to Article 5. And then we will go on, then we'll lay this bill over as amended, then we will go to the item next, which would be the Runbeck Bill 2538. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Joan Tuich. I'm an attorney for the Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee.
Hey, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll be going over Article 5. There's two provisions. Section 1 provides that notices of determination and actions of the commissioner sent by electronic mail to the person's last known electronic mailing address is sufficient if the person has agreed to accept the notice electronically. This is similar to language that exists in Chapter 270C that applies to orders of assessment at the present time. Section 2 requires that wage levy disclosure statements and wage levy payments be made electronically. And that's the end of Article 5 and conclusion of the bill.
I wish you could shorten it up just a bit, please. Anyone that wishes to testify on Article 5, for Article 5, or with concerns thereof? Questions from members on Article 5? You're good. Oh, not that good. Representative Carlson.
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman. Yesterday we had a little discussion about being able to do things, fax them electronically, and here we are having a conversation about... doing a number of things electronically, and I'll just renew my request that the department review whether that's a rule or a law that created that situation that I guess she's not here. Representative Depke brought up yesterday about the constituent and the time of 3 hours back and forth to resolve an issue.
Ms. Von Mosch?
Oh, Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, what I can tell you about the ability to transmit things electronically is it depends on the type of information that is involved. So if it is a Social Security number, a Minnesota taxpayer identification number, a federal identification number, we have, there are certain limits on the ability to be able to fax or email that type of information because of the lack of security. We do have available in the department, if you are a business or if you are someone who frequently would be communicating with us, you can get a secure communication link with us. So there are certain limits, and part of it is just because with email, it really is not a very secure form of communication. The person who does our information security equated it to a postcard. Like if you're emailing that kind of sensitive, either private or non-public information, it is just like it could be looked at by anyone along the route. We are working as an agency to try to get to implement something called an extranet, where there can be more secure communications between taxpayers and auditors, or even just taxpayers and filing. But it is one of those situations where the information is very sensitive, and we have a real responsibility to keep taxpayer information confidential, to make sure that it is not accidentally released, and that is. But the situation varies depending on the form, depending on what the communication is. I don't know the situation in the specific example that was brought out, but we are operating under some of those types of restrictions.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and I'm happy you're looking into it. And if there are ways to do it securely, you know, a few years ago I was strictly pencil paper with my tax returns, and then I went to TurboTax, and then things got a little more complicated, so I now go to a CPA, but we do everything electronically.
Right. And
so thank
Mr.
you.
Chair, Representative, those types of communications are secure when you're filing your taxes electronically, and it's just to make sure that other methods of communicating between the department and a taxpayer are also secure.
Very good. Thank
Carlson.
You.
Mm-hmm. Gentleman from Wabasha, Representative Duskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious along that line of discussion, if there's some sort of acknowledgement of receipt of the transmission that's included in the standard that looks like it might be in Chapter 325L, or exactly how do we know for sure that the person received the email you send them using this approach? Is that built into the approach?
Ms. Van Maan?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think for some of this sensitive information, we would not be emailing it. I don't know if I know the exact answer to your question, but you mean if you're emailing it through one of the secure channels with the encryption information?
Representative Duskowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm just looking at the language here. It suggests that a determination or action of the commissioner or other information can be sent essentially via electronic means. Are we ensuring that when the department sends it to the taxpayer that they received it, so that you know that your communication to them was received? Because we do have the ability electronically to do that. It would prevent confusion, it would certainly be a customer service type of thing. Prevent extra calls to you because of something not happening correctly on their end. I'm just talking about this generally.
Ms. Van Maan?
And Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know the answer to your question. I'm going to have to check and get back to you on that.
Representative Duskowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Duskowski. Okay, with that, I will lay over House File 2691 as amended, and if there is anyone in the audience that has any questions of the author, please contact the author. If you have any real tough questions about the bill, please contact Bobby, Mr. Rubis, or Anna. Okay, with that, we will go to House File 2538, a runback bill. Representative Runbeck moves House File 2538. Members, we will not be taking a vote on this, but we do want to go through this. Representative Runbeck moves.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
House File 2538. I believe is there an amendment? There is no amendment. Okay, so we're working off the CEH 253-1. Please, members, note the revenue note. And you have your information from House Research. Welcome to your committee, Chair Runbeck. If you could please describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Luckily, I have Mr. Michaels alongside me here. What you have is a very technical cleanup bill that is really going to discard a number of provisions related to economic development, obsolete chapters, and so on. So I'm going to ask him if he would go through the bill.
Mr. Michael, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir, and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Joel Michael from House Research.
And Mr. Michael, before you get started, I'd like to thank the department for their work today, also as some of them are leaving. Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as Representative Runbeck said, this bill is an effort to essentially eliminate a lot of deadwood and obsolete provisions from Chapter 469, which is the economic development chapter. I'm not going to bore you by going through the details of all of it. What I will do is briefly describe some of the obsolete programs that are being repealed by this. Some of these programs just have never been implemented or used, and so it made sense to eliminate them from the statutes. Some of them, by their own terms, have gone beyond their expiration dates. There are a couple of substantive provisions that arguably are substantive or that are substantive, and I'll highlight those for you so that we can talk about those in more detail if you wish.
But Mr. Michael, before we continue here, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, sir, but is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on behalf of House File 2538 or with concerns thereof? Kind of get a gauge here. Okay, Representative Mike, or excuse me, Mr. Michael.
And in putting this bill together, I worked with the Department of Revenue staff and the Department of Economic Development staff, as well as the border cities, because they're one of the biggest stakeholders that are affected by some of the rewriting that's going on. Some of the programs that are affected by this is the 2005 enactment of the International Economic Development Zone. Some of you know this is the air freight zone. That was just never implemented, and it's been abandoned. What this also repeals is the old 1983 enterprise zone law that expired back in the mid-90s. That was intertwined with the border city enterprise zone, which is still an active program. And so what the changes do is just to go strike to eliminate the obsolete provisions, but preserve the border city provisions and redesignate those. The pre-79 tax increment financing law, those districts expired at the end of 2009, and so they're no longer a factor. In the early 1990s, when the federal government had a couple of enterprise zone laws, Minnesota enacted enterprise zone laws to enable us to participate in those federal laws. That's all expired now. And then there's a bunch of individual provisions that had expiration dates on them that are expired. And so this bill goes through and eliminates all of those provisions. There are some provisions also related to the Northwest Airlines financing related to tax increment that are obsolete. The bill does make I think I want to highlight three substantive changes for you. If you look on the summary, and the summary numbering does not match the bill you have, because in the division there were a couple of sections that were deleted from the bill, and the summary has not been updated. When we hear the omnibus technical bill tomorrow, we'll have an updated summary. But on the summary, if you look at section 20, this is a provision that's arguably substantive. The old HRA law had authority to dissolve HRAs that had certain limited special benefit taxes that were imposed before 1953 and participated in a federal law. That all of that's obsolete, but rather than simply repealing this provision, the bill strikes that and makes this into a general authority for a city that wishes to dissolve its HRA that it can do so. So this now would provide a mechanism for cities that wish to dissolve their HRA to do that if they wish to. So that's a substantive provision. If you turn next to section 39, this too is a substantive provision, and it was done for two reasons. One, to provide a tax increment financing adjustment to original net tax capacity as a result of the enactment of the new market value exclusion. And so this would treat the market value exclusion on the same, the same way the state treats property that becomes tax exempt in a tax increment district or classification ratio changes. The other change that this makes is that the legislature split the Green Acres program into two separate programs, the Green Acres program and the Rural Preserves program, and this adjusts the TIF provisions that relate to Green Acres to make them apply to both Green Acres and the new Rural Preserves program. The third provision that I want to point out that could be arguably a substantive provision is in the repealer, which is in section 43, and it's the repeal of 469.043. This is old authority that authorizes HRAs to grant property tax exemptions for economic development. It used to be tied to creation of a redevelopment company. In 87, the legislature recodified the HRA statute into chapter 469, repealed that redevelopment company provision and made this a general provision. To my knowledge, it was used once back under the old law where it had to create a redevelopment company. It has not been used since then, so after 25 plus years. And since the legislature has since enacted the Economic Development Abatement Law, which gives sort of similar kinds of powers, the bill repeals that, but it does take away a power that an HRA could use. with that that I think I won't go into any more unless members have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. Chair Runbeck, do you have anything to add?
No, I don't, Mr. Chair.
Members, any questions on House File 2538? Representative Gottwald.
Just one, Mr. Chair, perhaps for Representative Runbeck or Mr. Michaels. This is technical. I know we're eliminating a lot of arcane stuff. Is there any impact to existing cities, TIF districts, things that a city might go, oh my gosh, you just did something to me? Or is this all...
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, no, I don't believe that there will be any of that effect. This was distributed to the League of Cities, the state auditor, and lots of practitioners have looked at it, and so I don't think that's the case. I'll be surprised if it is, and if it is, we'll have to come back and fix it or something, but yeah. Okay.
Representative Gottwald? Nope. Mr. Michael, do you know approximately how many pages of statute this is going to eliminate?
Mr. Chair, it depends upon if you look at the repealers, which are not attached to this, there are 19 pages of sections that are repealed. So it should shorten the statutes by a few pages and save a little bit of paper.
Very good. Any other questions? Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Michael, can you give us a little more discussion around Section 20, the dissolution of the HRAs and their authority? Now, does that applies to counties as well as cities? If you could give us a little context, or me anyway, that would be helpful.
Mr. Chairman, this, Representative Jaskowski, this does amend the portion of the HRA statute that explicitly refers to HRAs that are created by cities, but the county HRA authority says that they're treated as a city for purposes of that, so I would think it would apply to county HRAs. But in order to qualify for this, the HRA has to be inactive. And most of the county HRAs are active. I think where you would encounter an inactive HRA is usually a city that in the past was a larger city, its population has declined, and it's not, or they've had a change in philosophy and they simply don't think they want to continue to use the HRA and they want to use, for example, an EDA instead, and so they would just as soon eliminate their HRA. And dissolve it and transfer the assets, and this would just give them the ability to do that. Whereas now it refers to this, you had to have this old, 1953 tax levy and participate not have obligations to the federal government and so forth that really made this sort of a meaningless provision in the past. So I think this may give, it could, if a city has a desire to dissolve an HRA as opposed to coming to the legislature and asking for a special law, they could use this.
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Michael.
Any other questions, member? Chair Davids, do you have anything you'd like to add before we adjourn?
I would just say that 10:15 tomorrow, we will be working on some more department bills. And then try to put a bill together here that's more the technical type of bill. And all I would say is good government all the time.
Okay, Representative Runbeck, if you want to renew your motion to lay over House File 2538.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll renew my motion to lay over House File 38 for possible inclusion.
It's laid over. Thank you very much. This meeting is adjourned.